All right, my name is Bob Church, and I'm the administrative pastor from Calvary Chapel in Albuquerque, and I've been on staff there for almost 12 years, and my background is in economics and finance, just to give you a little bit of update on me. And what I'd like to do today is that I have an opportunity to talk to Calvaries all over the United States in the area of finance and setting up ministries and some of those kind of detailed technical areas. And what I'd really like to do in doing some of these seminars in the past, I'd really like to be available mostly to answer your questions. Because I know a lot of you probably, when you got your outline, thought, there's a question that I need answered, and I want to find out what that answer is. So it's really important for me to be able to answer your questions, but to help kind of get those questions going and maybe, you know, spunk your mind after, being, in this area. I listed in some of the things that in the churches that I've met with and talked with over the years, I've kind of come up with my top 10 list. It's kind of a David Letterman top 10 list. And these are basically areas that I think that either churches misunderstand or that they make mistakes in, or there's some confusion in what the Internal Revenue Service is speaking about, or they're very gray areas. And hopefully I will help you put some definition on some of those areas today. So first area that I want to just cover is the idea of what we call the improper classification of assets. And for those of you who have been through I call them the software wars in the nonprofit world, there's not a lot of great stuff out there. There's some inexpensive stuff, like in QuickBooks and QuickBooks Pro, and then there's nothing really in the middle of the road. There's this huge gap. And then you get into the more expensive accounting programs, Shelby, MIP Fund Accounting, and some of those. And those are $6,000, $7,000, $8,000. And the support on them is about $1,500 a year. And so for churches with smaller budgets, it's unrealistic. And some of these programs are not very helpful when it comes to getting your financial report set up correctly. So one area that I found a lot of churches do is they improperly classify their assets. And what I mean by that is you need, as a ministry, to come up with a benchmark, okay? It can vary. A lot of ministries use the $250 mark. A lot of ministries use the $500 mark. And what that is when you buy a piece of equipment, something that is an asset that has sellable value, it's not a negative on your books. It's a positive on your assets, on your balance sheet. And so what happens is if you take that asset, say you go out and you buy, a DAT recording machine, and you take that and you create that and treat that as an expense to your ministry, first of all, it never hits your balance sheet as an asset, so it doesn't help your financial position. And second of all, when you're looking at what we would call a statement of activities or an income and expense report, it shows it as something that's been expended out. And it's really not true, because all you're doing is you're trading one asset, which is cash, for another asset, which is a piece of equipment. So it's really important that you go back, and if you're a senior pastor and you have somebody who is either full-time or part-time doing your books, you need to look this over, because what happens in this area is that it will cause you to make bad financial decisions, because in a lot of cases, if you're not putting your assets kind of out of the realm of your income and expense, then you think you have less money than you really do. And so you can be in a position where you're saying, well, God, we don't have any money. We don't have any money for this children's program or whatever, and it might not be true. It might be that you just haven't properly classified your asset. And so that's one area that I've seen, and it's pretty prevalent. I've seen in a lot of cases that it's a general thing that they don't put their assets in the right place. So, and if you have more questions about that, I'll be glad to talk to you specifically after this, and I can answer those questions, because I do want to get to the point where you can ask questions. Number two is really the lack of separation between contributions and revenues. I think this is a really, really, really important area, because a lot of times we will look financially at our church over a period of years and say, we're growing. Okay, well, my question to you is what is growing? Are your contributions growing? Are your revenues growing because as a ministry you're now doing more activities, and so you're having more retreats, you have a bookstore now, you've had a seminar that you charge for or whatever. So it's really simple. Is those things that are given as a contribution need to be classified as a contribution. And a contribution is not something that somebody receives a benefit for, a direct benefit. Okay, it's an indirect benefit. So if I'm going to a men's retreat and I'm paying for my housing and the speakers and all those kind of things, I'm receiving a direct benefit. I get to go to a men's retreat, and that's revenue to you. That has nothing to do with a contribution. And a contribution is just when Bob Church writes out his little tithe check to Calvary and sticks it in the box or in the offering plate or whatever. That's a contribution. I think that's really important that you separate those two and you be very, very careful on how you do that. Because in another sense, it will cause you to make bad financial decisions. Because if you're a church just starting out and all of a sudden you decide, hey, let's have a women's retreat, and all of a sudden this one month, you know, say your income every month is, I don't know, $10,000, and all of a sudden it spikes up to like $18,000 or something, you think, God, we just grew $8,000 in that month. That means I can go out and buy that new tape deck, or we can get that new sound system. And $8,000 of that growth is a women's ministry retreat. Well, you have to expense that right back out the bottom line to pay for that retreat. And you're going to think, I shouldn't have done that. And the only way that you can do that is that if you have a proper separation in your accounting between your contributions and your revenues. So that's really important. It's a big thing. And as you grow, even if, you know, we're a fairly large church and we are very, very careful about that, because we want to make sure that the revenue side is taking care of itself, that the revenue side are things that it's really kind of a tit-for-tat thing. It means is that, you know, we've got sales coming in and expensive purchases going out. We have income coming in for retreats and seminars and all those kind of things. But that same income is going right back out the door. So it's not discretionary funds. It's non-discretionary funds.
So revenue's all cafe, bookstore.
Yes.
Anything that's
right. Yeah, the question was, is revenue is cafe, bookstore, anything? Yes, absolutely. Anything that is non... Right. We call it support or contributions versus revenue. Revenue includes sales, you know, anything that would fall under something that you're earning income for, a product sale or a service sold. Okay, that's basically the general idea behind that. So make sure you separate your contributions and your revenue. Third one is no depreciation of assets. Now, somebody asked me this one time, because in the business world, you have to depreciate your assets because it's part of your tax reporting to the federal government. And because of the fact that we are churches, we're exempt from that kind of reporting. You know, we're exempt from the 990, so there's no real form that we have to send the government every year, like our balance sheet or anything like that. We do, because we own a for-profit radio station, so we have to fill out what we call a 990T and show them all of our activity in that radio station. But for the church as a whole, we don't. So they say, well, why are you so concerned about depreciation? Well, first of all, I think one of the main reasons is it gives you an idea of how old your stuff is. It really does. I mean, if you have $50,000 worth of equipment and your depreciation is $45,000, what that means is your stuff is getting pretty old. That's what it means. Is that if you are doing it, if you're doing your depreciation correctly, and what we do on our depreciation is we use a salvage value, and that's equal to 10% of the purchase price. So if we spend $1,000 for a piece of equipment, our salvage value is $100. It's really, really simple. This depreciation thing is not a difficult thing. You can do it on a piece of paper. And so if I have a $1,000 asset, I'm going to multiply it by 10%, so I'm going to have $100 depreciation. So what that means is that I have $900, of salvage value, I'm sorry. I have $900 left of that asset to depreciate. All right? What we do is we basically run a 3, a 5, and a 10-year depreciation. And you know, it depends on your accountant and, you know, what kind of a piece of equipment it is. Computers, in today's times, I mean, a year might be too long. But generally accepted accounting principles will allow you to have 3 years on a computer. And so you take that computer and you say, we have $900 worth of depreciation on that. So your first year is going to be $300. Your second year is going to be $300. And your third year is going to be $300. And so that means at the end of the first year, that computer is worth $600. It's worth $300 after that. And then, I divided that wrong. 900 by, well, whatever. Okay, should be about, yeah, no, that's right. Yeah, and then you've got $100 worth of I'm sorry, there you go. It's $1,000. It's $400, $700, $400, $100. And there's your salvage value, okay? And so basically at the end of the life at 3 years, it's going to be worth the salvage value. And the reason we do depreciation, number one, is that it gives you an idea of how old your assets are. Number two, from an accounting standpoint, you need to show it on your balance sheet. You need to show that you can't overstate the value of the ministry on the books. You cannot do that. Okay, so if you don't have depreciation and you're going to the bank for a loan, that might be the first question they ask you. God, you got all this equipment, but you don't have any depreciation? And you're going to go, well, we don't depreciate anything. Well, they're going to make you go back and depreciate it because they want to see what you're really worth. And when you go to a bank, that's important to them. They're going to ask you for a balance sheet. And some of you might say, go ahead. That's where you need to set a value. And that's the point is you need to set a value. I think a fair value is $250. I think that's a fair value. So anything over $250, some ministries use $500. I like to capitalize as much stuff as possible. It's a little bit more work, but $250 to me is a reasonable depreciation on something. And so then how we do it is we have a whole program that we put the piece of equipment in there, we depreciate it, we have tags, we do the whole shoot match because we inventory it every year because we want to know, first of all, are we getting ripped off? Is somebody walking in here and stealing our monitors and all those kind of things? And also we want to know where it's at. So we tag it and put a location and everything. So you can be as detailed or non-detailed as you want. That's a good question. You know, what about chairs? If you go out and you say, like this room here, and you got 500 chairs, and, you know, in a cumulative, they're worth $5,000, but each chair is worth, you know, 10 bucks a piece. We actually have talked to our accountants and talked them into allowing us on those kind of big purchases to go ahead and show it on our books as an asset and go ahead and depreciate it. We don't tag every single chair. I mean, but when you go out and buy 2,100 church chairs, that's a lot of money. And for us to have to show that as an expense is really kind of an unfair idea because you can still sell those chairs. They still have value at the end. And so just because one item is not worth $250, they'll let us look at it in total. And so we'll be able to go back and say, here's our purchase of church chairs and make it as one big accumulative purchase. And I think it's completely legitimate. They don't have a problem with it. Yeah.
So what would be 5 years?
5 years, generally 10 years is like furniture, unless you're just beating it to death. I mean, that's it. But generally speaking, furniture, generally sound equipment for us will be 5 years because we take really good care of our sound equipment. And most stuff, we'll kind of let it, we'll end up using it pretty much for that time. And 3 years are things like high turnover items. Computers mostly are 3 years because, you know, any more, they're just, they're in and out, and they break so fast, and you're constantly fixing them and all that. So, yes. Yes, they do have a publication.
Now,
yeah.
My concern on computers, aren't they considered listed property? How do you get around that?
No, because, see, we're not under the same rules. And, see, that's – do you know what I mean?
Yeah, that's true. I know our banker said that he thought they should be fine.
Yeah. And you know what? And that's very possible. We worked with our auditors, and they felt like 3 was a better number, just because of the fact of the way technology has, and that they felt like the IRS was a little bit behind on that. Yeah, yeah, that's exactly right. Yes. Oh, absolutely.
But the other thing I found out at the church I went to, you have to be careful with depreciation, but they were throwing it as an expense into the P&L, and I'm real heavy on keeping a cash-based budget, otherwise, because you can't spend depreciation, and to get that mixed up with your cash budget can really confuse them.
Yeah, I think you need to be careful, but also I think you need to, in fairness, when you look at your operation, you need to expense your depreciation, because it really truly reflects... I've had some ministries do this, which I think is real interesting. We haven't done this yet. We'd like to eventually. Is what they will do is they buy back their depreciation. And what I mean by that is say that their depreciation for a one-year period is, say, $50,000. Well, I know ministries that will take that $50,000 and put it away in a special account to purchase assets again because that they've expensed that much depreciation out. And you're right. I mean, I think you need to be careful. I think you just need to understand that depreciation is part of your operation. And really, truly, is it's an expense to you. You do have to expense your depreciation because the assets are less valuable than when you bought them. And so you're right. I mean, it can mess you up, but we expense it every single month. And it hasn't been a real problem because we know on our financial reports, we have our depreciation on its own single line item. So we know exactly how much our depreciation is. Because also in the same vein, I don't think you want to negatively reflect what your financial status is to a bank or anybody else if you're not expensing your depreciation. You know what I mean? Yeah, and I think it's exactly right. You can keep a parallel system. We don't. We just expense it and recognize it's the cost of doing business, and so that's how we leave it. Yes. Yeah, on a monthly basis, we do ours. Just so it doesn't, come back and we don't have to make this huge expense at the end of the year. We don't do a cash flow statement except for our audit. We for us internally, we just keep a balance sheet and a statement of revenue expenses. So our income, we call it a statement of activity. We do a cash flow statement for our audit, and our auditors do that, and we look at that. It's important to us, but we don't look at that on a monthly basis. Just because, I've got a good enough feel now, right? A lot of it just depends on, your expertise, and if you like a cash flow, I find statement of activities is better for me. It gives me a better feel for the ministry instead of a cash flow. But some people like cash flows better. Yes. Yep. I think you're exactly right. And so, it depends on your flavor. And it depends on your auditors and how you set up your books. Some people just run, they don't even run a balance sheet. They run QuickBooks or whatever, and they have it in there, but they don't really understand it. And they're just looking at, income and expense on a monthly basis, and a cash flow doesn't mean anything to them. So, it depends on if your people understand that or don't understand that. We just have a good enough feel on our statement of activity that we know what's going on, what we have ahead of us, all those kind of things.
I pastor a church of 400 people, and I do everything myself, and I don't even know what P&L stands for.
Yeah, yeah.
Could you simplify this a little bit?
Yeah, sure, absolutely. And I'm gonna get to that. I'll get to that in a second. I know, and it's confusing at first. And let me get to that, okay? Number four, let's go on so we don't get too hung up. Sending ministers 1099s instead of W-2s. Hopefully, this myth and all these rumors are dead. I hope every one of you as a pastor gets a W-2. Please don't tell me that you're getting a 1099. Because if you're getting a 1099, I don't care what you say, you're doing it wrong. I don't care what your tax guy says, you're doing it wrong. And if you are getting a 1099, which is really, kind of self-employed compensation, that's what it is. Is if you're getting a 1099 and you're getting benefits from the church, any kind of life insurance, anything like that, you need to be taxed on that, just to let you know. Because if you're getting a W-2 as an employee, you can receive health insurance benefits as long as the rest of your staff is getting them without being taxed on those. So I think it's really important. Hopefully this myth is gone. We are self-employed employees, but we still get a W-2. We get a W-2. Uh-huh. Yeah, how we do ours, we don't use a form. We use it on the W-2 in box 14. And we just put under, and we just write in there, we type it in our computer, housing allowance, and we put the dollar amount. Completely fine. No problem at all. As long as, at first, you really technically, you don't really even have to show it. It's not a reporting requirement with the IRS. You don't have to say, this is my housing allowance. As long as you have it in your board notes, for the previous year, you know, that you voted on it the previous year for the following year. So 1999, you voted for your 2000 housing allowance. We show it in box 14 just to have it there. And then, and we do a lot of for our guys because they forget what their housing allowance is. It kind of prompts them. So when they go get their tax guy do it, when he fills out their forms, he knows what their housing allowance is. I'm going to work my way forward here. Let me just give you, here's one. No, if you read the tax law cases, what you'll find right now is if you get a 1099, you know what your chance of being audited are? 500 times greater than a W-2. So that's my only question. You want to put your senior pastor under that kind of exposure? I'm serious. 1099s have become, they're death to you. I'm not kidding. The IRS is going after 1099 people like crazy. I mean, I don't know if you read the current church law and tax report. They're telling you, 1099 guys are getting hammered. They're getting hammered. If you offered me a 1099, I wouldn't take it. Go ahead, right here. If he's not an employee, you do. Well, if he gets a 1099, he's technically not an employee. Okay, is he getting a W-2?
Yeah.
Then he's fine. No problem. No, as long as you offer the same benefits to, if you hire a secretary, a full-time, I mean, you have to distinguish. As long as you offer the same benefits to other people that are on your staff paid, then you don't have to tax him. If he gets some benefit that is not a cross-the-board benefit for everybody else, then he's taxed on it. She needs to get a W-2, okay? Yes. Doesn't make any difference. She's an employee, okay? She's not a contract laborer. You could fire her. You can tell her what to do. She has probably regular hours, the whole thing. She's an employee. Yeah, and she would get a W-2, and part-time you can distinguish. You can say we only offer benefits to full-time employees, and you don't have to pay her benefits. No.
If I'm not going to get taxed
on that? No. Well, how it works with the gas card is that as long as you can substantiate your expenses on your gas card for business use, then it's not taxable to you. But whatever is personal is taxable. So if you drive to and from work on your gas card for the church, that's taxable income to you.
Okay.
Oh, yeah. That's called commuting. Commuting is not a business expense. Right. It's not a business expense. There the hands go up. Oh, no. Yep. Yep, it's exactly right. You can do a couple of things. One, getting senior pastors to keep a log. Let's live in reality, okay? What we like to do is we'll take 1 month and make them keep a log, and then once they keep a log for a month, most of the laws have stood up against that. And then, or, see, what we'll do is we'll keep a log, and then we'll say, okay, 40% of his time is personal, 60% of it's business. We'll apply that for the whole year. And generally, it's okay. Generally, it's okay. Okay. No, and I don't, you know what, I have an old saying is like, you know, never put a red flag in front of a bull. So, you know, if you don't have to report, don't report. On a housing allowance, there wouldn't be any reason because it doesn't affect the 941. The only thing that would affect him is if he exceeded his housing allowance and his expenses or didn't come to that level, and he'd have to report that as income.
Okay, but you don't have to
send him a W-2. No, you shouldn't have to. Yes. Oh, absolutely. Yeah, right. If he hasn't opted out, correct. Yes. Yeah, there's a whole bunch of stuff that comes with that. I'm opted out, so I don't. I signed that 4361 right away. Yeah. Let me go over here.
Senior pastor is paid mostly through the housing allowance, very low salary.
That's not a problem.
We just use 1099, and we haven't seen an advantage of going to the
I just, you know what, I just think you're putting your guy in a real awkward place. I mean, the point is what's the difference? I mean, from the standpoint of how you report it, there's really no difference. For a guy who's getting a housing allowance, who's opted out of Social Security, so you're not dealing with federal withholding, you're not dealing with FICA, you're not dealing with 941, all those kind of things, I say the advantage is fill out the W-2, do a W-3 at the end of the year, and you're not going to run into those same kind of problems. I really do. I mean, just everything that I'm reading is saying you're just putting yourself out there with the 1099. And I don't think it's necessary that we do something that would get us necessarily audited. Not that we can't withstand an audit, but why? Why do you want to go through that pain and suffering?
We have an office, our church secretary is just a stipend.
I still don't, you know what, if they're an employee, they're an employee. And that's the point, is basically the only people that get 1099s from us are, we do it a little bit different than Jeff Jackson is they W-2 their missionaries. We're not there yet. We haven't determined that that's really the way we want to go because they're really not employees. And we really can't show that they are. So I vary a little bit different from him. But on honorariums, if you come in and speak and we give you money, you'll get a 1099 if you get over $600. Contractors are the guys to watch out for really carefully. Because these guys are shady dudes when it comes to that. They will tell you, I always ask our contractors, are you incorporated? Yes. Oh, really? Can I see the ink behind your name? Can I see your incorporation papers? Because they will tell you that because they don't want you to give them a 1099 because they don't want to report the income. But contractors are notorious for that. Musicians get a 1099. Anybody that provides services to us who's not incorporated. Graphics artists people are really good at that. They have these little small businesses and they're doing stuff on the side, they get a 1099 because they're providing a service. You're not buying copy paper from them. They are giving you a service. You're buying their time. They get it. That's income. Yes. Yes, it's exactly what we do. Once we get somebody that we think is potentially going to go in that area, we give them a W-9. And the W-9 just basically says, you got to tell us your Social Security number. And if they don't do that, we make it really simple. We have their check attached to the W-9. And if they don't sign the W-9, we don't give them the check. It's pretty easy. And you know what? They sign it every time. It's an amazing concept. Go ahead. Yes, ma'am. No. If you haven't opted out, it doesn't say that. I've never seen anything documentation saying that you had to state a housing allowance in box 14. That is where you put it. That's a good idea. That's where you put it if you want to put it. But for like us who opt out, we don't have to show it on the W-2.
Okay. If you haven't opted out, if you're still paying all the FICA for Social Security, and if the major portion of your income is housing, you may get still some, through the church for salary, then all the church has to then start paying their portion of the FICA, their portion of the Social Security.
No. No, here's the thing is okay, here's where it gets real confusing. This is where people really get this messed up. If you are an ordained minister, well really, according to the IRS, licensed, commissioned, or ordained, okay, so one of those three. How they distinguish between what licensed, commissioned, and ordained is, who knows? I mean, it's subject really kind of to us. We don't license anybody or commission anybody in Albuquerque. We only ordain. And so we don't have any licensed secretaries or we kind of look at it like, an ordination is a special thing, and that's just the way it is. So we ordain. If you are ordained, all right, we cannot withhold FICA from you. You can withhold it, you can opt to withhold it, and tell us through additional withholding on your taxes. But you still are responsible for it. But we cannot withhold it from you. If you come and say, I got to pay FICA, you need to withhold it. Nope. We are not responsible for that 7.65%. You are. Because as a pastor, you're a self-employed employee. So from a tax reporting standpoint to the Internal Revenue Service, you're self-employed. For other things, you're an employee. So it's a really strange whack-hammer rule, and it doesn't make any sense, but that's the way it is. So the point is that the church is never responsible for 7.65%. Now, your board might go back and go, I'm sorry that you have to pay that additional 7.65%. So we're going to kick that in. Okay, great. They can kick it in, but you're also responsible for the Social Security and all on that. It's just this rolling ball that just continues to get bigger and bigger. So you always end up with only a fraction of that. You never get a clean number from there. Okay? Right there. They're just like regular employees. Church pays 7.65%. You pay your Medicare and your Social Security and your SET. Well, good for them. I have a hard time believing that the problem is you can have a religious disagreement all you want till you're blue in the face, but you have to perform three functions according to the IRS to be licensed, commissioned, or ordained. One is you have to be involved in the care or maintenance of a religious organization. You have to perform what they call sacerdotal functions, which is ministerial rites. It's a big word. But what it means is you got to be able to baptize, marry, and bury, basically. I mean, you know, a priest, a minister, somebody who is involved in the religious rites, not R-I-G-H-T, R-I-T-E-S, of a ministry. And you have to have some kind of influence in that organization. So if you don't qualify for those three things, you can't be licensed, commissioned, or ordained according to the IRS. You're not eligible for a housing allowance to the IRS. So you got to be really careful. I mean, secretaries that get a housing allowance, I ain't going to work. I don't want to be around you. Yeah.
For those who have opted out, are you still doing their withholding for them or letting them pay that?
We tell our guys, grow up and be big boys. Do your own withholding. I mean, if they come back and say, please, will you withhold, we will. But we just basically, how many guys opt out so that the church can withhold? That's why they opt out, because they get more money. Then they got to just kind of figure it out themselves. So that's how we do it. We've never had any problems with it. So. Yeah, but see, here's the thing is we have people sign W-9s who we think potentially could get to over $600 in a year. See, because what happens is it's not against the law to sign a W-9. I mean, there's no magic formula here. But we might have a guy who's a musician and we think, guy, you know, he's here and he might come again. And so we just think, you know, if they're going to get close to that number, if we think, well, we're going to give them $500 or whatever, we have them sign a W-9 just in case, because it's sure easier to have that number and track them down before the end of the year. Because to come into the year and you're at, you know, end of January trying to track all these guys down and trying to leave them voicemail and getting their Social Security number, it's really hard. And you got to get your reporting in, so that's why we do it. Okay.
And he's got two on staff. And on the rules on the housing allowance, what I got from the IRS is that it can't be more than a reasonable salary.
Well, here's what the housing allowance really states. It can't be more than what they call the fair market rental value.
Okay. But they had another rule in there saying that it can't be more than a reasonable salary. And so what we're looking at, and he ended up calling the IRS, and they said that it can't be more than half of what, like you would have to give half the salary.
Never heard that before in my life. Never heard that. If it is, they haven't told a soul. They haven't. I don't think. So. I don't. I think that somebody from the IRS misinformed you. A housing allowance is a housing allowance. It has nothing to do with a fair wage. It has to do with the fair market rental value. And I have a little form that I can show you how to fill that out. And it's really great.
I got it out of the Sonderman book.
Okay.
Ministerial Finance.
Uh huh. Mm-hmm. You'd have to show that to me. I've never, ever heard that before in my life.
I just heard it this year.
No.
So.
Here's the thing with the housing allowance where you got to be careful is you got to be able to substantiate what the fair market rental value is. It's kind of a nebulous number. I mean, it's really hard to kind of land on that thing. But the point is that, I mean, if you got a guy who's making $20,000 a year and you give him a $100,000 housing allowance, you know, that's kind of a strange thing. So, you know, most of the time, your housing allowance is going to be somewhere around probably his expenses for his housing, which based on where he lives and his salary and all those kind of things are kind of going to fit. I mean, they should. I mean,
what's happened is he's got an outside job.
Mm-hmm.
And the church wants to pay him, and they want to make his check housing allowance.
Okay. As long as it doesn't exceed the fair market rental value, there's... And plus, the thing is that, I mean, how much are you going to possibly pay the guy? Do you see what I mean?
Yeah, it looks like the IRS wanted a balance between the salary and the housing.
I've never seen that because I know guys who make like $1,000 a year in salary and like $12,000 or $14,000 a year in housing allowance. There's no balance there, and there's no problems at all. Seen, been through auditors and everything. It's no problem. Way back there. Why?
Well, it was unclear then. I never did get a clear
You know.
My tax guy still says the same thing today because you're a pastor. And the board has elected to call it parking. Okay, that's what I want.
Is that what they called it? Housing allowance? Okay, well, I mean, if it's called housing allowance. Okay, here's the thing about housing allowance. Okay. Did they designate it as housing allowance in their board minutes?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
Then you know what? Here's the thing. If you get a $10,000 a year housing allowance, okay, and you can substantiate receipts, which means your house payment, utilities, you know, gardening, I mean, whatever. You know, basically the sort of rules say that everything besides food and maid service. I mean, that's really true. And the care and maintenance of a home. So, like, if you go out and, you know, work in the yard and you buy new grass or something, you could take that under your housing allowance. That's completely fine. If you buy furniture, whatever. If you can substantiate all that $10,000 a year in housing allowance, then you don't have to show that as income. If you can substantiate $8,000 of the $10,000, you've got $2,000 of additional income. Okay? If you have $12,000 of receipts on a $10,000 housing allowance, you just lost $2,000 that you could have deducted. Okay? That's how it basically works. There's a couple things you can do is that you can have your board state in their minutes that this remains perpetual until changed by the board. Okay, but I think that needs to be stated that way. And or they can do it every single year. We do it every year for one reason only, that we can review it. That's all. It's just to us it's a matter of being able to go in and talk to the guys and say, you know, has your house expenses gone up? Are we doing you justice here? Have you exceeded your housing allowance? All those kind of things, because we're still within quite a bit of the range of the fair rental market value. Okay?
One trick we found this year is that someone has to purchase the house. All of the purchasing money that went into it was able to be deducted as housing allowance.
Right. But here's the thing that happens when we get older is once we pay off our home, our housing allowance kind of goes away.
Right.
And I've been reading quite a bit about that, and it's like, you know, in a sense, it's almost like you're better off keeping your mortgage. I mean, from a tax standpoint, it's, you know, take the money and go put it in the stock market or something. But keep that housing allowance because tax-wise, you're actually better off. I mean, it's a benefit that nobody in this world has except pastors. I mean, ordained, licensed commissions and ordained. It's a sweet deal. You mean if you go over your...
No,
that's something that you do individually on your taxes. Under a, what is it? Form, is it Schedule C? Schedule C.
What about lottery wins?
If you win the Powerball, you know what? I think you need to, like, yeah, do that for God's work there. Yes. Yes, and amen. They are. Sure. If you reimburse the deductible, that's a good question. You know what? Ask your tax guy that. I have never. You know what? My guess would be probably. The reason being is because here's the thing. You've got to be real. Yeah. It doesn't make. It's still. No, sure, but that's fine. But still, in the same sense, here's the thing is that your staff, when they receive a benefit, okay, the benefit has to be, what's the word they always use? Say you go out and you buy your staff turkeys for Christmas, Okay? It's nominal. It's a nominal benefit. You don't have to tax them for that. But say that you got this great secretary and she's really worked and had a, you know, done a great year, and you went out and bought her a $300 or $400 gift certificate to, you know, Foley's or whatever. That's taxable to her. Because it's not considered nominal anymore. It's compensation because she's an employee. And the question the IRS would ask you is would she normally receive that if she wasn't an employee? And so if she receives it as a direct result of being an employee, it's generally taxable. And so I would say, based on just not knowing exactly, because I've never dealt with that before, I could find out for you, but I would venture to say that is taxable income to them. Yeah. Yep. Yep. That's exactly right. You can do that. Right. That's exactly. Yeah. Yeah, medical savings account. Yep. Yeah, I'd be glad to. Okay. Misunderstanding specific designations. I think this is really important. Hopefully you guys understand what this means. But basically is when somebody makes a contribution to the church, it has to fall under what we call the control test. And if it doesn't meet what the IRS calls the control test, it's not tax deductible. So what that means is if Alan comes up to me and says, I got this guy in our church, and he's hurting and he needs his house payment. So I'm going to give you $500. I'm going to write the church a check and you're going to give it to him. I go, uh-uh. Sorry. Love the guy, but I'm not going to do it. You go give him the check. Because what happens is that we've lost, the church has lost control of those funds. Be very careful in this area. And people get, your congregants don't understand this. They get bummed at you. Well, I was just trying to help the guy out. Well, that's cool, but the Internal Revenue Service says, well, why don't you just go give them the money? Why do you have to use the church as a clearinghouse for your funds? A lot of people look at that very negatively. I look at it very positively. I actually like the law because it keeps people from manipulating you into doing something you might not necessarily want to do.
I think it goes back to motive, too.
Yeah.
If you really want to give the guy $500,
go give him $500. God will take care of you.
If you're giving it for the perk,
yeah.
Then, you know, are we giving for everything?
That's exactly right. So that's the one to be careful of, okay? Okay, I'll talk about that. Let's hold that to the end and I'll talk about that, because we've done some pretty extensive research on that and I can tell you some things. Another one is number 6 is no benevolence fund rules. And what I'm talking about this is we call it open arms. This is helping the poor. This is an area where it's a heartstring thing and we get taken and we're very vulnerable in this area. And I'm not saying that we shouldn't help the poor because the Bible tells us to help the poor. But I'm also saying that we need to do it with wisdom and discernment. And we have rules, and we set them up. And I think if you don't have rules, you're going to get burned. And my understanding at Costa Mesa, the rule is at least when I spoke to, Romaine, he said that basically is if they can't find any record of you ever giving money to the church, they don't give you any money. Too bad. That's just the way it works. You know, that's something that is you as a pastor and your board and or administrator, whatever, you guys need to figure out. We have them fill out forms. We try to ask them lots of questions. We like to see if they, you know, that they work, they can help at the church, some of those kind of things. You need to be very, very careful in that area. Okay, that's all. Yeah, I'll be glad to send them to you. Just when you're done, leave me your email address or whatever and we'll email them to you.
If somebody works for benevolence, do you have to pay $999?
No. Too small, and generally we've asked about that. And here's a point is you know, the IRS doesn't want to get a big black eye to say, here's a church who's helping homeless people, giving them enough money to go buy groceries or whatever, and now they want a 1099. I mean, then we're gonna have to start 1099ing the guy in the street corner that, you know, has a sign will work for food.
Right.
I mean, you know, there's gotta be some kind of flex here.
We generally
It's a great way. We always have a saying, never give drunk money. Because he's going to go drink it, so you're not helping his problem. So what we will do is you're exactly right. We will pay a hotel bill. We'll call the hotel and verify that they are staying there. We'll help them with that. We will pay electric bill. We'll go to, if they need to go to another city, we'll go down to Greyhound, pay the Greyhound bus. We never, ever give them cash directly, ever. We always find out what is it for, what's the specific purpose. Yes. Yep. That's exactly right, and that's a good sound advice. What's that? Yes. Yes. We'll have guys like, we had a guy at our church that he's been a giver for years, and he lost his job, and he couldn't pay his house payment. No questions. He paid his house payment. And the cool thing about that is because it's a gift, and they're not an employee, they're not really tied, they're not doing any services for the church, it's a gift, it's not taxable income to them, which is a beautiful thing. Because, you know, you don't want to give a guy $800 or $500 for his house payment, slap him with a 1099, and he has to pay 15% on the top of that, plus all the additional taxes. I mean, that'd be sad. Yeah. No, we don't do loans. Yeah, we don't do loans. We don't like loans. And the IRS is getting tougher on loans. Number seven, lack of easy to understand financial reports. And for those of you, you know, like Jim here, we can talk about that afterwards, about some of the what we're talking about, P&Ls and those kind of things. I think the best thing that you can do for your church is try to condense your financial reports. Is you know, your QuickBooks might come out with these huge, long lists of da-da-da-da-da. You might understand them, but, you know, if you're a senior pastor, you might not understand and think, why am I looking at all this stuff? If you're an administrator, your senior pastor might be asking, what am I looking at here? You know, if you've got a board and they go, could you give us a little bit more concise information? Excel's a great program. You can combine things. All I'm trying to state is make it simple to be able to read, so that how we do our board reports is that we give our board a bird's eye view, so then when they want to know specifics, we can provide them specifics till the end of the world. But we want to show them an overall operations, because I like to look at financial reports to look at an operation overall and say, this is the health of it, this is not, you know, those kind of things, instead of having to try to figure out, you know, 75 account numbers for supplies. It doesn't show me anything. It doesn't help me. Yeah, we do a flash report, and what we do is that we do a, you know, like every other week compilation. And so we do a compilation report so he can just get a status of where we're at. Yeah, so but once a month he gets a total operating report. But it's clear and concise. It's income, expenses, bottom line deal. Pretty simple.
Is that on Excel or is it on
Shelby? We use MIP fund accounting, but I know how to import it over to Excel and just it concise, makes it clear and concise. The next one is no clear, concise payroll standards. I think this is a biggie. This is an area of confusion. It's really difficult for churches. How much do you pay somebody? How do you find that out? What do you pay somebody when they come on staff? Huh?
What do you pay?
I'm not going to tell you. You go ask him. But you know what I mean? What do you pay somebody? What on earth do you pay your senior pastor? What about your assistants? All those kind of things. It's a difficult thing. You know, there's some churches fit models, some don't. Some are small, big, medium. Some have big extending outreach arms, some don't. Some have this, you know, where do you go from there? The thing that we're finding is we need to have some way of tying these things back together so it's not so kind of nebulous. So that if your pastor's audited, that they can't come back and say, well, guy, you know, here's a church that, you know, their income's $50,000 a year and, you know, well, I can't say that because if it's $50,000 and the pastor makes 30 of it, I don't generally have a problem because the poor guy's got to eat. But I mean, you know, say if it's $1 million operation and the pastor's making $200,000, then you've got some explaining to do. And so how do you find that out? Well, the best thing so far that I've found, I've gone through every book in the world and looked through this, pulled my hair out, and I found this thing finally. We participated in this. I don't know if you've seen this. It's called NACBA, National Association of Church Business Administrators. This thing rocks the planet. It's the best thing I've ever seen, because what it does is it breaks payroll compensation down by region, by denomination, by non-denomination, by budget, by church size. I mean, you can look at a zillion different variables, and it goes all the way from, you know, senior pastor down to the food service director. So I mean, some of those things don't really fit our lingo. Yeah, and I'm going to give you guys a handout. You probably already have it right there. It's NACBA. And I think this thing's like $25 or something. This thing's great because what it does is it gives you an idea, and it includes housing allowance, benefits, everything. So it gives you an idea just kind of where you can land. So you got an idea, so your board goes, we got this new guy, and what do we pay him? I think we need to have some kind of measurable, objective standards on those kind of things. It is. It's by geography, by location. It's phenomenal. So it's got tons and tons of places that you can do it. It's large church reports, national report, combined Protestant. You know, there's non-denominational, national denominational, male and female staff, north central region, part-time, western. There's a zillion different regions. So those are, this is a good book. I would recommend getting it. It's a good form. And then off their webpage. And it's on that second sheet. It's called NACLA. Yeah. Okay, great book, worth the money. Yes, didn't like it at all. It's too, like, it didn't give me enough information. It didn't, first of all, it didn't even touch a church our size. It wasn't even in the ballpark. We didn't even know where to land on that. So we had to find something that was more comparative. So it was, I think they were fair. I think they gave it a good try. This one's way better, way, way better. Also in your payroll standards is I think you need to come up with some policies. I know that's, you know, maybe a bad word in Calvary Chapel circles, but I think I've said that. I've been around long enough. I think I can say that with a fair amount of, you know, security to say that that's a good thing. Is you know, what about raises? What about reviews? What about treating people? You know, where do you line up on that? You know, or do you do a cost of living? Do you do a merit increase only? You know, when do you do raises? How do you do raises? All those kind of things. I think those are important things to think about. We do an annual review, and we, you know, base salary increases on that. We have basically we have a 6% cap on any increase in salary unless there's a change of position, and that's how it works. And so, you know, if a guy goes from a janitor to a pastor, we're obviously not just going to look at 6%, but you know, that's how we look at it, and we try to be very competitive in beginning wages. I think that's some of the key. But we also like to be conservative because we don't like to be in a position where we're paying somebody too much and they're not working out. Because it's easier to give somebody a raise than it is to tell them, we're not ever giving you a raise ever again for the rest of your life. So you might as well just quit. You know what I mean? It's a little bit easier to do that.
Yeah, I don't want to go too far with this question, but, like, you know, when a church is small, everything is kind of just, you know, you're getting by, you're surviving. Right?
You bet, sure.
And then the church grows 300.
Sure.
Okay?
Uh-huh. That's out of this world, yeah.
You know, how could you ever justify that? But there are guys that are out there doing that.
That's scary.
Guys in their own circle. That, I mean, not $1 million, but pretty exorbitant salaries. And who sets that guide?
Well, first of all, is that we are guided by that book there. That helps us land. We do surveys across the United States, independent surveys of other churches our size. And then also what we do is you recognize that anything over $100,000, the IRS considers, can consider excess compensation. And so you have to have a what they would call an attorney's review. And so you need to get somebody who knows what they're doing to review that and make sure it's... I don't have a problem paying somebody over $100,000 as long as that the church size and, you know, the ministry and all that stuff justifies it. And so the question is that...
I have a problem with that point. Just because of this, I did quite an extensive study of
Yeah, but you can't use Jim Baker as an example because he's way out of the box.
Yeah, but you know what, though? But if you read his book...
I've read both of them.
Yeah, you know what I mean? He said, you know, it all made sense on the papers.
Right, but the thing is they didn't have a standard to bring them back to, and I think that's an important point. It's, for us, that's why we drive off of this standard, is if you poll churches across America, I think you're going to find a pretty decent standard, and I don't think it's unreasonable by any way, shape, or form. I think that's the key, and Jim Baker was run by his own standard and his own board, and they were just voting basically by their guts. They had no qualification to get to the point where they got to. You know what I mean? They weren't able to justify any of the salary increases. They were ridiculous.
Right.
I mean, I read that book thoroughly, and it was like, no, they couldn't do that. So I think that's important. Number 9, too many miscellaneous expenses. I'll keep that really simple. If you spend something on a category more than once or twice, it's not miscellaneous anymore. Makes it really easy. Okay? I think it's really important because it can be a little bit confusing what the heck miscellaneous is. And when you're going back to look at a church or you're on a board or you're on the staff and you're looking at the financials, you go, what's miscellaneous? Well, miscellaneous could be miscellaneous. It is miscellaneous. But if it's really big, that means there's something in there that can be pulled out and categorized. So be careful of that. We sure do. We have a petty cash reimbursable fund that every petty cash expenditure has a general ledger account tied to it. No, goes into the general ledger. Yep, just as a petty cash account, but it's expensed through the general ledger. Mm-hmm. Yep. I'll give it to you at the end. Yeah, I'd be glad to. Okay, and then last one is the lack of understanding of 1099 rules. I think we kind of covered that a little bit, but remember, it's got to be over $600. And watch out for contractors. Watch out for graphics artists, computer technician kind of guys. Those are the areas where you find a lot of independent guys who start their own business and they haven't incorporated and they're just a DBA kind of business. They're just Joe Blow doing business as Computer Solutions or something. If they're doing service for you and you spend over $600 a year with them, they get a 1099, no questions. And if they don't want to sign that, don't give them any money anymore. Just say, well, I'll find somebody else.
We have some guys who kind of pitch in and volunteer, and they give us labor that's way below what they would normally get. And typically, if they submit receipts to us for reimbursement, and we just, like, let's say the receipts are for $160, we give them $200. Is that correct?
Yeah, I wouldn't do that. I wouldn't do anything that... Here's the thing about service labor, okay? It's not tax deductible. Like if I come to the church and I'm just serving there and I go, God, I'm a qualified electrician. I'm just going to serve at the church and I'm going to deduct my what I spend, how many hours times what I make as tax deduction. Service is not tax deductible. The IRS does not allow it. And so I would be really careful of doing anything that you couldn't back up with an audit with numbers. You know what I mean? And I think we need to be above board in all things. We need to be able to be scrutinized. And I appreciate the fact that they might be giving it under that. But I would just say, guys?
But what I'm saying is, they are asking us for that. We're just assuming that they're running around with the gas expenses. They hand us a pile of receipts, so I know that they're expensive. They're watching.
Well, it's a gift, but I'd be careful about that. I really would. I would be careful about getting in a pattern of gifting. Because the point is that, I'm not saying in a pattern of gifting to anybody, I'm just saying to somebody like that. Because then it gets to a point where it's like, you could question that. You could say, you guys are, this is what they're submitting, and really technically, you only have to reimburse them for what they're submitting, unless they give you an invoice for their services. Yeah, and so I would be real careful of that. Buy them a gift certificate, take their wife out for dinner or something. Something like that might be even a little bit better. I don't know. Sure. We do that a lot, too. Yeah. That's exactly right. Okay? Let me end with this and say, if you don't have any other questions, thank you. My email address is pretty simple. It's bob@calvaryabq.org. And I'll be glad to answer any questions and send you any resources that we have. And, any kind of some of the things to get. Guy back here was talking about church law and tax report. Awesome. Great. I've been to some of their seminars. I know Richard Hammer. He's a great guy. This is like the best stuff. It's a CD series. It's like $299, but you get a new updated one every year. I brought my 99 because of my 2000 is sitting in my computer because I use it all the time. But this thing is great. It's like everything you ever want to know about tax stuff and legal stuff and searchable database on CD-ROM. Great resource. It's under Christian Ministry. You can get Church Law and Tax Report. I don't get that anymore because I get it through the CD-ROM, but you can get a book. It's a good book. It goes through everything. Everything. This is an absolute must. If you're not getting this, you need to get this. It's $39 a year. It's Church Law and Tax Report. You get it on a monthly basis. This thing is phenomenal. It tells you what's going on, current legislation, liability, and also insurance companies are getting really, really tough on this whole sexual molestation deal. Limited liability for most insurance companies is $500,000. Period, end of argument. Limited liability. So that means if somebody comes in and sexually comes on your staff or is one of your nursery workers or whatever and molests somebody and they sue you for $1 million, your insurance is going to cover half of that. So some insurance companies, we work with a company, I don't know if they're in all areas, but it's called Brotherhood Mutual. They have, if you meet certain criteria and have certain standards, they will raise your limit to $1 million. If you have questions about that, you can email me, and we can show you what we did to meet those standards to raise our liability limit. But if you go through this, 80% right now of the cases going to court are molestation or sexual things with pastors. It's scary. Two years. You have 2 years. How it works is not necessarily ordination. It's 2 years in when you receive over $400 as ministerial compensation. So you have 2 years from the first time you receive over $400 in a year of ministerial compensation. From that date, you have 2 years to opt out, or you cannot opt out after that. Opt out 4361 is that you can opt out of paying Social Security. So like my check, I don't pay any Social Security on it. But that doesn't. But it also means that when I'm an old and gray, I don't get any Social Security back from it either. Correct. What you've paid in as a regular employee of another company or whatever. Pardon me? Any compensation. Yes. Housing allowance is included in that compensation $400 limit. Yeah, you're welcome.
This is Ian, aside two. If you'd like more information on tapes, please contact Chapel Tapes at P.O. Box 8000. Costa Mesa, California, 92628. God bless you.